I'm really happy to introduce you to Claire Snell-Rood. She's at the in the College of Medicine, University of Kentucky, and she comes to us with a medical anthropology background, which I am always so interested in. She's also actually doing work in an area that I do work in, so that's way cool, too, is incarcerated women. Pretty much an under-examined group, for sure. I think we might agree on that one. The focus of most of Dr. Snell-Rood's work has been on women's health disparities and mental health as well. So we're delighted to have you here and to discuss a topic that I don't think a lot of us know very much about. So please welcome Dr. Snell-Rood.
Thank you guys so much for being here in the afternoon. I appreciate it. And also thank you so much for the kind introduction. The presentation that I'll be giving today is Incarcerated Women's Strategies to Reduce the Influence of Risky Relationships on Their Drug Use. And I have no financial relationships to disclose. So one of the reasons why incarcerated women are increasingly becoming a topic of our research is because in the past few decades, there's been a sevenfold increase in the number of women who are incarcerated within the U.S. prison system. Much of this has been driven by the fact that there are more and more offenses which are now imprisonable, which are related to drugs, and a larger proportion of women, rather than men, are being incarcerated for these drug offenses. That means that when we look at the actual health issues within this population, we see a certain pattern of complex and interrelated health issues. We see mental health problems, which are frequently related to substance abuse issues, and many of these women also have a history of abuse and trauma. So part of the way that public health practitioners and researchers have looked at the intersection between all of these different health problems is to link women's drug use and overall poor mental health with some of the other risky health behaviors that are associated with these two conditions. Oftentimes, these health behaviors put women at increased risk of developing HCV and getting HIV because they were more likely to share needles and have unprotected sex. For many decades, sociologists and anthropologists have pointed out that women are more inclined to understand their own identity and sense of self through their relationships. And when we link this understanding of women's sense of self to these health behaviors, we can start to picture some of the pathways through which these are connected. First of all, women, if they are defining themselves through relationships, are going to be searching for connection with others, whether these are good connections or connections which aren't ultimately the best for women. Second, though women oftentimes are deeply embedded within their social networks, oftentimes they're in a vulnerable place within those networks. Sometimes they're forced to, they don't have the decision to ask for birth control or protection or to assert their own needs or desires related to needle use. Or even they can be in vulnerable positions within drug networks as well. And then finally, women are more likely to be subject to history of violence or emotional trauma, which leads to lifelong impacts on their mental health, which they may deal with through substance abuse. So in all of these ways, we see that women's relationships are centrally connected to these risky health behaviors that we're drawn to understanding as public health practitioners and researchers. So in recent years, interventionists have increasingly been drawn to addressing these health behaviors as a whole and in terms of how these health behaviors are intersecting with each other. One of the ways that interventionists have done this is by directly addressing intimate partner violence, getting women to be able to better understand some of the dynamics of their own relationships and to teach them tactics to get out of violent relationships as a way not only to decrease the violence they experience, but also the other health behaviors that might follow from that. Secondly, interventionists have really concentrated on getting women to better be able to advocate for themselves within their sexual relationships so that they can ask for more protection and teaching them strategies and tactics to do that within oftentimes unequal relationships. And then finally, the technique of motivational interviewing has been a strategy which has been oftentimes employed because it's a way to have women to reflect on their own strengths, their own life histories, increase their self-efficacy so that they're a bit better able to plan for the types of behavior changes that they'd like to put into place. As strong and as wonderful as these interventions are, we still have a few more steps to take in order for us to be able to address this complex tapestry of women's relationships which are affecting these interrelated health conditions. First of all, we need to develop interventions which can address women's relationships, not only their violent relationships in the present, but also their relationships over the life course and how those relationships from the time of birth up to the time of intervention are shaping women's vulnerability. Second of all, we need to understand not just those intimate relationships, but the broader family and community relationships, which oftentimes are stressful and also shaping women's health behaviors. Though oftentimes we've concentrated on some of the inequalities within women's drug-sharing relationships, we also need to look at some of the more codependent drug use relationships that might be pleasurable or supportive and understand some of the dynamics of how women are negotiating those relationships. And then finally, though the violence and trauma has really called to us most urgently in a very obvious way, oftentimes it's very important for us to understand the positive connections that women might be seeking within their daily relationships as well. So this small qualitative study is really seeking to, myself as a medical anthropologist, it's my interest in looking at what are the risks that women themselves are perceiving within their relationships, and then what are the actual behavior changes that they propose to reduce those risks, knowing that some of those might overlap with interventionist goals and some might diverge a bit. So this is a picture that you might have seen before of Lyndon B. Johnson visiting Eastern Kentucky in the early 60s. It was his first visit for the War on Poverty to Appalachia. Unfortunately, not a lot has changed within Eastern Kentucky, the part of Eastern Kentucky he visited, which you can see. It's the central part of Appalachia, and it actually also is one of the parts that has the worst poverty and health indicators for Appalachia as a whole. As you can see in this broader map, this dark clustering of maroon shows a very high incidence of drug poisoning deaths from heroin and other opioid drugs because this part of Appalachia is really the heart of a drug epidemic. It also, these health statistics overlap with poor mental health as a whole. You can see, again, in that same part of Kentucky, the blue and the purple shows that this part of Kentucky has more than twice the amount of poor mental health days per month than the rest of Kentucky. And I should say that Kentucky as a whole has the second highest rate of depression in the country. So this is the worst within a state that's already pretty bad. Also, this part of the state has very poor overall health outcomes. So I'm working, my collaborator, Michelle Staten-Tindall, is a professor in the School of Social Work. at the University of Kentucky. She has an R01-funded intervention study taking place within three different jails, within Eastern Kentucky. And they've been doing this intervention for several years now. They randomly selected inmates within these facilities and then screened them for their drug use because that was the primary concentration for participants. And then they've done an intervention over time in which participants were randomly assigned to either control or intervention groups. And then participants took place in at least 4 individual face-to-face motivational interviewing sessions with a counselor who would really help them to concentrate on strategies for their own behavior change, specifically related to their drug use and particularly concentrating on improving their risk factors for HIV and HCV. Some of the techniques that the therapists use along with this motivational interviewing technique are empathetic listening, focusing on women's strengths, and also thinking through practical strategies for behavior change. For our qualitative data analysis, what we did was we took 20 of these participants from the overall intervention sample, 20 women who had completed 4 sessions and had agreed to have all 4 sessions taped. Not all women agreed to have all of their sessions taped. And then what we did as a team was we had a kind of comprehensive, iterative qualitative data analysis strategy. Where what we did was we took 10 of these participants and looked through all of their transcripts. And from that, we identified both emergent themes and then also themes that really were in line with what we had seen within the literature. This here is a picture of one of the drafts of one section of our very, very long code book. And we each read these transcripts individually and then came together with our different codes, refined these codes, went back to the transcripts to make sure that they matched. And then from there, before the coding process started, I sat down with our coder and made sure that we had at least 80% agreement in the ways that we were coding the transcripts. In order to achieve that 80% agreement, we also had to go back to the code book one more time again to make sure that the code book was really accurate in defining what it was that we were seeing. And then from there, we did qualitative coding line by line within the transcripts with the software, a data analysis program, MaxQDA. This is a screenshot of what MaxQDA looks like for those of you who are unfamiliar. And you can see the little lines right by the text, that those are the codes within the text. So just to tell you a little bit about this sample of the 20 women, it's a rather young sample, 100% white, which matches pretty well with the demographics within Eastern Kentucky. About half the population is married. And many have completed most of high school, and nearly all women have children. And this is a very low income population as well. All of the women had used drugs at some point in time, and many of them had used multiple different types of drugs. Also, many of the different women within this sample had used drugs within the very recent past. And then, though this study was really oriented around substance users specifically, you can see from these statistics here that the vast majority of women also had comorbid mental health issues, which shouldn't be surprising based on what we've seen about this population in the past. So I'd like to just go through three main themes that came up within our qualitative data analysis. They're big themes that have a lot of different parts in them, and I'm really open to questions or comments afterwards. But what I've done is just break down different aspects of these themes with quotes from the women so that you can get a sense of what it means within their own words and what it is that we mean. So first of all, women when talking about and envisioning their own behavior strain, behavior change, they emphasized that their relationships in which they did use, even those that were supportive or loving or long-term, they needed to accept the fact that those relationships might need to end. And as women looked at these relationships, they really concentrated on the control that they could possibly be able to exert over themselves within these relationships, even though they were complex and dynamic and sometimes not equal. Women stressed the fact that they needed to be able to separate their own process and goals for behavior change from the goals that the other people with whom they used may or may not have. And oftentimes they knew that these people with whom they used had a vision for change, but didn't necessarily have the will or a plan in order to act it out. And oftentimes, quite painfully, women expressed the need that they needed to prioritize their own behavior change over others. And sometimes that was quite painful because it meant letting go of their hope that others could change. And sometimes it also meant terminating relationships that they felt were really detrimental toward their own desires to change their behaviors. Secondly, women concentrated on actually have some material exactly on their children's relation, on the relationship with children in the two slides later. Because these relationships here are mostly talking about women's relationships with their intimate partners and also with their immediate family members, many of whom also they had used with over the, some of them since the time they were teenagers. So I'll delay the answer, if that's okay. Secondly, women were concentrated on specific strategies that they could develop that would let them avoid abusive relationships. And here I don't mean just their intimate abusive relationships, the relationships we usually think of when we think of IPV. But women were really concentrated on the broader scope of their relationships, including their community relationships and family relationships that they also felt could be psychologically, emotionally, or physically abusive. And then they felt that developing these strategies were really essential toward promoting their own mental health, and in so doing, therefore enabling the fact that they wanted to quit drugs that they often felt were a coping behavior for poor mental health. Women really centrally argued in interview after interview how few of them had had real resources for social support at every different stage of their life. And within their broader social environment, they felt that there were multiple risks that they faced. We aren't talking about risks as in the types of health risks that we talk about as public health practitioners, but women felt that by engaging with others at any point in time, they were opening themselves up to potential use again in the future. And sometimes this meant being skeptical even of their very most intimate relationships that they wanted to rely on. And then finally, women concentrated on identifying specific relationships that no matter what, they knew that they could not be within because they caused so much stress that they always made women want to use. So finally, women concentrated on the positive relationships that they felt really motivated them to want to change. And oftentimes these were their relationships with their children, because as you saw, 90% of the women in the sample were mothers, and oftentimes mothers of multiple children. So they felt that this was a real a way to substitute the draw and the challenge that they faced with a much more positive emphasis. Part of this was women being able to concentrate on the ways that they could define themselves, oftentimes in contrast to negative messages that they received from their family, community, and partners over time. So by defining themselves, they felt that they were able to go ahead shaping the terms of their broader relationships. Secondly, they use these relationships as a motivation, as a way to not only want to make that change, but also believe that they had the capacity to. But part of this had to do with contrasting who they were when they were using with who they were when they weren't using, oftentimes really desiring to be that person that they were when they weren't using within their relationships. And then finally, and quite painfully, women recognized that during the process of the behavior change that they saw once they got out of jail, they would continue to be vulnerable. And sometimes that meant that they would need to protect their family members from themselves and their own vulnerability in the immediate future. So just in conclusion, from this qualitative data analysis, we see a much more complex social environment, not just involving intimate partner relationships, but also the broader family and community relationships. And then we see that though risky behaviors have been the concentration of many interventions, actually women are talking about the much broader strategies through which they can negotiate their relationships. And then finally, we see the really central importance of positive relationship to the way that women are planning their behavior change. So thank you guys so much for being here today, and I look forward to your feedback. There are some options for Suboxone treatment in this region, but like you could see in the diagram, the jails are within three very different areas, and they have varying degrees of access depending on where they live. And these rural areas, they're not only very rural, but they're very mountainous. So getting to places, it really takes a long time. And because this is such a low-income population, it means that, I was talking with you about this earlier, that very few people have cars, so they have to engage in all kinds of favors to get to these clinics. And then oftentimes they might have to pay at the clinics. So there are women who are interested in that. But it's not the easiest thing, unfortunately. Yeah, thank you.
I think the difficulty in studying all of these populations, but it's wonderful you can bring tape recorders in, because we can't at Shakopee Women's Prison, so it's a hard thing to do.